That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
You're listening to Intelligence Squared. COP26, the gathering of world leaders looking to combat climate change, takes place over the next 2 weeks. Here at Intelligence Squared, we'll be taking this as an opportunity to explore some of the debates, big and small, surrounding the climate emergency. You can catch our Sunday debate on the opening day this weekend, which asks, is COP26 a turning point for the planet? But first up, a quick primer on what COP actually is, why it matters, and whether superpowers such as China, the United States, and the European Union could be doing more to help. Here's The Economist, Linda Yu, with more.
Over the next 12 days, world leaders, strategists, campaigners, and a few global multinationals too are set to descend on Glasgow in Scotland for COP26, the world's most prominent global summit that seeks to address the climate crisis. The guest list is as significant for those who haven't turned up as it is for those who have. Chinese leader Xi Jinping won't be there, and neither will Russia's Vladimir Putin. Two seats at the table who jointly account for a third of annual greenhouse gas emissions. But U.S. President Joe Biden will be appearing. More on that later. Joining us to talk through it all is Isabel Hilton. She's founder of China Dialogue, a journalist and climate specialist who has been awarded an OBE for services promoting environmental awareness in China. We're also joined by Akshat Rathi, climate and energy reporter at Bloomberg News. A warm welcome to you both. Would you mind giving us a brief history, Isabel, of COP, previous summits, and indeed, what does COP stand for?
COP stands for Conference of the Parties, and it's an annual event, and these are parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the foundational document of global climate action. And the UNFCCC, that's the convention that recognized anthropogenic climate change and acknowledged the need of the global community to do something about it. It set up scientific assessments, which produced very regular reports, both on climate science, on impacts, on all kinds of aspects of climate science. And that's advanced enormously since it was first set up. We're now at the 26th meeting. We missed last year's because of the pandemic. Along the way, there have been protocols and separate agreements which are under the UNFCCC. So there was the Kyoto Agreement, for example, which ran for quite a number of years. There was an attempt to replace that at Copenhagen, which failed. And finally, we got the Paris Agreement, which is the current kind of action plan. So we agreed in principle with the UNFCCC that we had to do something. And for the next 26 years, we have been debating and actually making progress, putting systems in place and so on. But it's a long and complicated business. And of course, the effort has to continue because we've wasted a lot of time. We haven't moved as fast as we need to. So we really need to get down to it before 2030 or things get very, very difficult indeed. So the object of Glasgow, we're not negotiating a new treaty here. We're trying to make the Paris Agreement work. And that means meeting those ambitions which are embedded in the Paris Agreement, which is net zero by 2050, and keeping global average temperature rises to well below 2 degrees. And that's pretty much been revised down to 1.5 as, you know, the highest you can go without tipping into a real climate catastrophe. So the ambitions on the table, the plans that each country brings to the COP, we need to get those into alignment with that 1.5 degree goal. That may not happen, but we have to make progress there, or the system might be seen to simply not to be working. So that's what COP is all about this time.
Mm. And Akshar, just on that, what are you keeping an eye out for at COP26?
As you said, it's going to be a lot of people, a lot of big names, a lot of countries coming up with their own agendas, trying to hash out hopefully a deal by the end of it. Just to be able to keep a track of all this, and because we're going to be a small team of people covering it, we've taken on 5 priorities. Some of them are ones that the COP leadership has already put out. So, for example, countries have to come with higher ambition on emission reductions. That's top priority, and a lot of that work had to be done before the meeting actually started, with countries submitting plans for this. Another goal that, again, the COP presidency has is to be able to negotiate a deal on carbon markets globally. It's called Article 6. It's the text within the Paris Agreement. And it's been a complicated matter for countries to be able to agree upon. And every time they have passed the ball on to the next COP, and eventually here we are, and that needs to be sorted. There is also discussion that needs to happen. And again, something the presidency wants to do is to bring $100 billion worth of financing to be given to developing countries to help with reducing emissions, but also to adapt to the sort of warming that is coming. Now, beyond these 3 priorities, there are 2 others that we are hoping to keep an eye out on. One is how much can we get a movement on the reduction in the use of coal? And another one is how much would countries move on reducing emissions from methane, which is a super warming gas.
All fascinating areas. And I do want to probe into them in a moment. But first, let me ask Isabel, what are you going to be looking for?
Well, as Akshar says, it's a big and complicated process and with lots of moving parts. But as China Dialogue, of course, we will be watching very closely what the Chinese delegation does and says and how that goes down with the rest of the participants. We'll also be watching India quite closely. India doesn't get the same level of attention that China does, partly because its emissions are not nearly so high. But its potential for increasing its emissions is very high. So, you know, what India's plans are to develop its energy economy without adding too much coal at this point is clearly of interest. It has a big solar program, but it doesn't have a very highly fleshed out climate strategy as far as we can see. And then the European Union, which does have a green plan, will be one of the, you know, pivotal entities here. There are essentially 3 big blocks. There's China, the United States, and the European Union. And how they interact, what the relations are like between them, whether they can cooperate or compete, all of that will be an interesting dynamic at this particular COP, because the politics have changed so radically since we were all at Paris in 2015.
A couple of countries, China and Russia, have set 2060 goals. Just talk us through what the implications of that might be. And is there something the rest of the world can uniformly do to try and address this crisis?
So the Paris Agreement is actually quite a short document. If you just search for it on Google and download it and read it, it really is quite readable and it's quite short. Now, because it is short, it leaves out quite a few details. So, for example, Isabel brought up net zero by 2050. That's the goal that scientists tell us is the goal we have to meet if we want to reach and keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And it's a carbon dioxide goal. It's only one of the 4 or 5 greenhouse gases that we have to worry about. If we want to keep it below 2 degrees Celsius, which is a higher temperature, which will come with much more damage to the planet, we actually have more room to reach net zero, so to speak. And what you get from developing countries especially, and China still counts itself as one, is that they would like more time to be able to reach this net zero target, because they say, and they are right about it objectively, that rich countries have been using up the carbon budget through the use of fossil fuels in the decades and perhaps centuries past to be able to become wealthy and developed. So that's the argument for some countries, and it's not just China and Russia, but Saudi Arabia this week, that declared a net zero goal for 2060 rather than 2050. And one other thing that we probably can learn from the dynamics is that these goals are likely to be brought forward. I mean, we've already seen that happen with Germany. Germany earlier this year had a goal of 2050. Its court said, no, that goal is not good enough. And then they brought the net zero goal to 2045. So it's good for us to see countries set these goals. But as Isabel said, if we want to keep it below 1.5 degrees Celsius, we really ought to be aiming for 2050.
Yeah, I think, Isabel, you mentioned 2030 as a key date, and China's committed to peak emissions by 2030, and that's really not that far away. So do give your take on this question as well.
Well, that was one of two promises that Xi Jinping made in at the UN General Assembly in 2020. He came back this year in 2021 to the UN and added another important promise that China would no longer build new coal-fired power stations on the Belt and Road, so outside China, and that China would support countries to develop low-carbon renewable systems, those countries that still need to equip themselves with energy, that still have the right to develop, which nobody disputes, to equip them with the means to do it without locking themselves into high-carbon pathways is incredibly important, and developed countries need to assist developing countries to do that. China's status in this is ambiguous, and it's been ambiguous since China became the world's biggest emitter in 2005. Because although China, you know, in many ways claims it's a developing country, it's by now a middle-income country. It is by so far and away the world's biggest emitter that if China doesn't act really quite radically, then the rest of the world's efforts are, you know, are pretty hard to produce a result if the world's biggest emitter, you know, doesn't act quickly. And so a lot of countries feel, although sympathetic to China, you know, we can't go on playing that card forever because, frankly, you know, the impact on everybody, on the entire world is so big that China, and the impact on China is also very big, that those goals, I think, will have to come forward. What China does have, though, in its favor, a couple of things. It's based an industrial strategy on a low-carbon future. So its industrial and technological future is premised on the world taking action on climate change because it dominates the production of renewables and all the technologies associated with climate action. And secondly, its mitigation isn't really going fast enough, but I think that it will. The 2030 goal is a loose target, frankly. It was on the table in Paris 6 years ago. It was regarded as a fairly loose target then, and they could bring it forward. But because of the geopolitics and because of anxieties about energy security in China, they're being extremely conservative about that goal. So instead of bringing it forward for this COP, for example, I think we're not going to see very much movement there, possibly 2028. And the problem is, the later they leave the Peking, the harder it is after 2030 to reach their own goal of a 2060 net neutrality, zero carbon ambition. And that matters a great deal because the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees is really, really big. So we lose virtually all of the ocean's corals at 2 degrees. We only lose 90% of them at 1.5. That's bad enough. To lose all of them means you lose the ocean nurseries. And there are many, many, many other major effects that kick in between 1.5 and 2 degrees. So it does matter. It matters to China too, because the impacts on China will be extremely severe. So everyone is hoping that Chinese characteristic of setting goals which you then overfulfill is going to kick in here, because if they only just get to 2030 before they peak, that's really quite difficult.
I think China is not the only country facing difficulties. Akshat, you've mentioned quite a lot of money is required for developing countries, but let's actually pause for a moment and just on the United States, the other major emitter. Just tell me about the commitments the U.S. has made and the kinds of challenges that Joe Biden himself is facing in terms of trying to move off of fossil fuels. I believe his proposal for a carbon tax, that's not getting a very warm welcome by lawmakers, is it?
Yes, so the U.S. is the second largest emitter, and historically speaking, if we count all the emissions that have been put into the atmosphere, the U.S. is actually still the largest emitter. And the US also has a very complicated politics around climate change. There are two parties, and two parties are completely opposed on their views about how to resolve the problem of climate change. Now, just before Biden came to power, of course, it was Donald Trump from the Republican Party, and he pulled the US out of the Paris Agreement. So the US is coming to the table with a lot of baggage, and Joe Biden knows that, and Joe Biden's team knows that. And so they actually tried their best, in at least at the early part of the game, by putting up a cabinet-level position. Secretary John Kerry, who was previously, when Paris Agreement was signed, the Secretary of State, to try and drum up the diplomatic wins that the U.S., with its large diplomatic arms around the world, could pull off. And they've been mildly successful in certain things. So, you know, the goals that that Saudi Arabia has set for net zero, or the UAE's goal for net zero, can count to some extent for U.S. pressure. Just today we heard that Australia is going to set a goal for net zero by 2050. There was also diplomatic pressure from the U.S. But when you turn inward, the domestic politics are still as bad as they were. Right. Joe Biden is in power, but he hasn't been able to get through a climate plan that could deliver the kinds of cuts that they have pledged already for 2030. And they have set a goal to reach net zero by 2050. Within those plans, that unless the politics are sorted, and it's not just a politics of Democratic Party versus Republicans, but there are certain Democratic leaders within the party who are opposed to radical action on climate. And until that is resolved, we are going to be in this position where the U.S. sort of is going to be a drag on global climate negotiations.
But Joe Biden is expected to be at COP. Xi Jinping is not expected to be at COP26. So Isabel, just analyze what that means for success at the summit.
Well, it would clearly be a boost to morale were Xi Jinping to be there. But it should be noted that Xi Jinping hasn't actually left China at all since the end of January 2020. So it's not that he is specifically not coming to the COP. He hasn't been to the UN twice. He's not going to be at G20. And he didn't even go to the opening of COP15, which is the biodiversity conference of the parties, which China hosted in Kunming. So Xi Jinping not traveling is a fairly, you know, that's a fairly settled pattern at the moment. So I don't think we should take it as a sign of lack of interest. Who will be there is Xie Jianhua, who is the Chinese equivalent of John Kerry. And the two are, they know each other well. They've both been involved in this process for a very long time. Poor Xie Jianhua keeps trying to retire, and he keeps getting brought back in because he's such a kind of pillar of Chinese climate action and a very well-known figure around the circuit. He's trusted. He's very well liked. And Xie Jianhua will be the person that we look to, both to communicate what China is bringing to the table, but also to ensure with John Kerry that what is, in general terms, I think a fairly toxic moment in US-China relations does not contaminate too much the conversations that those two have been having on a very regular basis and will continue to have through the COP and afterwards, because those two are the linchpin of the diplomacy between their two countries on climate. And that relationship is pretty important. So Xie Jianhua being there, he's a serious player and he will bring serious plans.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
And
another major block that will be there is the European Union. And of course, I do want to come to this issue of financing. Lots of governments feel quite strapped themselves in terms of fiscal resources because of the pandemic. So Akshat, what role do you think the European Union might play at COP, and do assess whether or not this 100 billion or so for developing countries might be forthcoming?
So the European Union has been among the large blocs, the most climate forward, and has been pushing on the climate agenda for a very long time. Now, it has had some struggles, of course, with the UK going towards Brexit in the past few years, and the UK being the host of COP26. And those struggles have sort of played in the background as they have tried to work together to hold a more ambitious event in Glasgow. In terms of the things that they have done which have made a difference, the US and the EU, for example, worked on a methane pledge earlier this year, and about 36 countries now have signed up to it. And they're aiming to reduce methane emissions, which come from oil and gas infrastructure, but also from agriculture and from waste management, by 30% by 2030. And that, if it works out, could reduce temperatures by 0.2 degrees Celsius. So in a goal where you're between 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming, which is what we are at today, and 1.5 where you want to keep it, 0.2 degrees Celsius can make a huge difference. So that's been a win for the European Union so far. In terms of trying to get the $100 billion worth of climate finance, the EU has done a lot too. Now, if you look at the contributions that different countries have to make based on their economic heft, the EU countries in general have done far better than the US. The US ought to be contributing as much as $40 billion out of the $100 billion, but it's only raised its ambition to about $11 billion. And we learned this week that they are, as a group, are not going to be able to deliver on the $100 billion figure until 2023, which is 3 years later than promised. And that's not going to go down very well with the developing country bloc. So that's already becoming a little bit of a friction as we go into the talks at COP26 in Glasgow.
Yeah, I think that financial assistance is going to be a massive issue for lots of developing countries looking at this pandemic context. I think another issue that I know the WTO Director General, who I had a chance to recently speak to at an event, she was advocating from the stage a need for a global carbon tax. And I mentioned there the United States, that's fallen off of the Biden plan. It didn't get political support. But Isabel, it'd be good to get your sense as to what coordinated action, is it a carbon tax? Is it other things that might be needed to coordinate the realization of these targets?
I think in an ideal world, a coordinated carbon tax would be very helpful. I can't really, it certainly isn't going to happen in Glasgow, and the obstacles on the way to it, I think, are quite considerable. This question of transfer of funds to developing countries has been built into the whole UNFCCC really since Kyoto. I mean, essentially for more than 25 years, we've been discussing who does what and who pays for it. And that's the kind of crux of all of these discussions. And it was recognized in Kyoto that there would be a need to transfer funds. And in that phase, in the Kyoto Protocol, it was done through a thing called the Clean Development Mechanism. It was like a trading system. So industrial enterprises in advanced countries, for example, which were relatively efficient, could support less efficient enterprises in developing countries to clean up. And they would get credit for it, and the overall reduction in carbon, you know, was a good thing. China was a massive beneficiary of that in the first phase. So China has had a great deal of inbound transfer over the years under climate programs. That whole system ended, and we are nevertheless left with another residue of the Kyoto Protocol, which was carbon trading. The biggest system is the European trading system, which has been going a number of years and has never managed to get the price up to the level that it really makes a difference. China has established its own trading system, and the price is on the floor. So a trading system only works if the price of carbon is high. It needs to be about $80 a ton, and, you know, it's way off that. So these trading systems are kind of meant to be a market-based mechanism for reducing carbon. And in principle, possibly yes. But the fact that they don't deliver, or they have not yet really delivered very much, has made people return to the idea that a tax might be a much simpler mechanism. But if you impose a tax, you then have the question of how you trade goods. And you see this discussion, for example, in the European Union now, where you have quite a radical program for reducing emissions, for example, from steel or from, you know, other industrial sectors. That's going to make the goods more expensive to produce. And you have to protect them from what's called carbon leakage, from goods produced in countries which don't have these stringent climate rules. So the proposal is that there be a border tax, which protects your low carbon production against damage from high carbon competition. It's called CBAM, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. Now, that's quite controversial, and certainly China doesn't like it. The United States is pretty hostile. So as we move to the implementation of these great climate ambitions, we're going to get many, many issues like this, where trade interests and economic interests collide with climate interests. And that's going to take a lot of working out, to be honest. I don't think there are any easy solutions in any of this.
Akshat, we're quickly running out of time, but I do want to get your take, because Isabel's absolutely right. You know, the price or the quantity of carbon is essentially what globally countries have been looking at. And this issue of carbon leakage, the European Yes. Union is moving forward on looking at a border adjustment mechanism, essentially a tariff that would try and prevent some of the dynamics that she's describing. So what is your take on sort of the global coordinated mechanism that we need to see in order to help us get to these targets and the commitments that we hope are coming from these countries?
So one thing we haven't talked about, and it's not a topic that comes up at COP, because as Isabel said, COP is about who is doing what and who will pay for doing that. But there is an underlying force that has been helping out with climate negotiations, which is progress on technologies. right? We've had solar power and wind power fall drastically in prices. We've seen the same trend play out in batteries and now electric cars. The next generation of technologies that would need to do the same are hydrogen produced from renewables, and perhaps carbon capture technology, which may be required in some specific industries like cement or steel, where it's too expensive to be able to rebuild a steel factory that was just built 10 years ago. And so you retrofit it with something that can capture the emissions and bury it underground. Of course, all of that would be helped with a carbon price and agreed a global coordinated carbon price. But even if we don't have that, there are mechanisms through which you can put in an implicit carbon price. So countries around the world, and it's not just the European Union or the UK or the US, are providing, for example, credits to buy electric cars, which is an implicit carbon price on a gasoline-powered car. And those kinds of credit mechanisms which governments can take and industries can use to be able to push forward these green goals can have a huge impact. And what we will see, I believe, is that at the COP meeting, it's not just going to be countries meeting and talking about the text and what is going to go into the final agreement, but there'll be noise made by businesses outside trying to help governments sort of give them the political cover to go forward. And I think even though there's a lot of greenwashing in business, there has not been as much momentum on business as there is today. And that's definitely a positive sign going into the negotiations.
I'm going to try to conclude on a positive note, but I don't know if I'm going to succeed because I'm going to ask each of you what needs to happen for COP26 in Glasgow to be a success. Isabel, you first.
We've talked about the 100 billion, and that is, it's a very important symbolic target because it does express the fact that we are all in this together and that we need solidarity. And frankly, you know, the advanced economies have not been, have not stepped up. They've disappointed, and that's unfortunate. But I would say that what is really going to make a difference to emerging economies and the developing world is not the 100 billion, which is really neither here nor there, except as a promise and a commitment and a sign of seriousness. What really matters is the trillions. What matters is the finance and unlocking finance and directing finance into low carbon development. That is really the key to much more rapid progress. There are signs that this is beginning to shift. The returns on investment in renewables have been rather better than the returns on investment in fossil fuels. I think that there is a much more awareness now in private finance, in banks, in investment vehicles, that this is necessary, desirable, and potentially quite profitable. But there are barriers, particularly for poorer countries, the cost of capital, the question of how risk is regarded. And I think that we will see, and certainly in the margins of COP, very serious conversations about how we move that sector along. And I think we will also see a lot of industry pledges. I think we will see a broader front, if you like, on climate, because the public awareness of climate and therefore the awareness of many different institutions outside government is much higher. And I think that the conversation is therefore broader and richer, and there are always more positives in those areas than there are in the political conversations between countries.
Thank you, Isabel. Same question to you, Akshat. What would you need to see to declare COP26 in Glasgow a success on the pages of Bloomberg News?
I think I laid out the five things that we are looking for. To me, it feels rather wrong to say it succeeded or it failed. What we would like to see is progress. And if we see progress on all of those measures, we can be sure about it. Or we can say there's not been enough progress or there's been more progress than we thought. That is how I would frame the whether we succeeded or not question. I would give one other point, which I think is crucial. So between Paris and now, in 2018, there was a very important report released by the United Nations in October. It was called, as United Nations reports are called, the Special Report on 1.5 degrees Celsius. And in its understatedness, it actually galvanized a huge force. The children that come on the streets and protest do so because of reading that report. The net zero goals that countries are setting are because of that report. The net zero emissions targets that finance people are setting for their portfolios are because of that report. And if we all agree on a coordinated way to reach a specific measurable point and what every party has to do in it, that I think that kind of clarity has been lacking from the climate fight so far. And we have that now because of the 2018 report. And I think that makes a huge difference going into COP26.
Really good point. But I'm just going to press you for a moment, which is, what do you think is the likelihood of COP26 delivering on all five measures and factors that you're looking at?
So if we go through those five things, higher ambition, we are still waiting on India and China to submit their pledges. And if they do, that will make a difference. And I think those will come and they will look better than what we've been hoping. And so that's probably going to be a success. On finance, we already know that the $100 billion figure is not coming till 2023. So that already looks like a failure. On methane emissions, you know, the number of countries that were pledging has already become 3,000, and we might get a few more. And that looks like a success. On coal, I'm afraid because of the energy crunch that we are going through and the need to be able to use accessible sources of energy, we might not see higher pledges. So that looks like a failure. The real wild card is Article 6. If we do get a deal on Article 6 on creating this carbon market, which is good and sensible, that might make a difference. But it's so complicated, it's really hard to see if that happens.
I can see Isabel shaking her head there, but a really great analysis from both of you. A huge thank you to our guests, Isabel Hilton from China Dialogue and Akshat Rathi from Bloomberg News. I'm Linda Yu, and thank you all for listening.